that we're doing right now in Ways and Means. It puts into statute the idea of prioritizing programs and services. It puts into statute the idea of the performance measures and performance outcomes being the key element, if you will, in the budget process. I think this is a great step forward, a huge step forward, in improving how we do things. It lays it out so the members of the legislature all see what's going on, all understand up front the general sense of where we're going. And I think we could have our co-chair's budget reflect that, rather than being the work of two people, would reflect the work of the legislature early on. I'd like to think in our budget this session, we tried to do some of that based on your committee work, but this would be a much better, much more coherent, much more transparent process. It has a hammer in it, in that we suggest in this particular piece of legislation that while policy bills can be worked and moved, and even moved from one chamber to the next, they cannot pass two chambers until this resolution is adopted by the body as a whole that defines the general outline of the budget process. It forces us to come to grips with these difficult issues early on, and I think that's what's needed for a little integrity and a little honesty and a little transparency in this whole budget process. Embedded in that is also changing the culture of how we do things in the building, particularly with the agencies as well as ourselves, and that's where 1039 comes in, because that actually talks about doing performance excellence review like a lot of businesses do, and some public agencies do in other parts of our state and other states. So, Mr. Chair, we'd recommend these bills for your consideration and hope you act favorably on them.
Thank you.
Any questions of the co-chair? Let's wait till we hear from Senator Morris, if that's okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, colleagues. For the record, Frank Morris, representing District 8, Albany and Corvallis areas. I'd like to extend my appreciation to the co-chairs for bringing this bill to this point and allowing the public hearing, and to you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill. With respect to 474, I look at this bill as a way of putting thoughtful discipline in a process that is extremely difficult, looking at all of the different needs of our state government and how do we memorialize those needs in a document that is reflective of the will of the body. I believe that if we start this process with a budget resolution that allows us as a body to agree, look at the history of where we've been, agree on the broad allocations that we need to focus on, and then from those broad allocations then get more and more specific as we go deeper into the budgets. But to do that early on, allowing the assembly to say, yeah, this is a reasonable approach. Take these broad numbers and go forward and do good work, to the Ways and Means committee members. What you find is, if I believe that if you don't have this kind of a resolution document that makes the reservations that we all agree upon based on risk, which is the ending fund balance, agreement as to what is that prudent ending fund balance, reservation for emergency funds, broad allocations for adjustments and salaries, steps, merits, those kinds of things, and then make the allocation to the six Ways and Means subcommittees, and then give those subcommittees some latitude based on the hearing processes that we have. We're a very committee-driven budget process. In contrast, interestingly, to our neighbors to the north, Washington's process does not involve the kind of committee hearings that we have on agencies and budgets. They have two budget writers, one in the Senate, one in the House. They each have their own staffs, and they craft essentially the budget. And it's then presented in one omnibus budget bill to each chamber. And where they then differ, they have a resolution process to bring out one final budget. So there are different ways to do this. But given Oregon's strong tradition and history in the committee process, providing greater structure to that and allowing the committees, I think, to perform in a different way than we have in the past would be, I think, a positive step. With respect to Senate Bill 1039, what I'd like to do is just reference the whereases, if I may. And in a lot of legislation, the whereases are not as significant, but I believe they are in this particular bill. Whereas the state cannot legislate excellence, but can expect it, support it, and acknowledge it when it occurs. And whereas excellence is a passion, and when it exists, the legislative assembly should support it fully. And whereas the purpose of this legislation is to create a process that will oversee the journey to excellence and will encourage the most vital aspects of Oregon state government to be managed at a world-class level. I would suggest to you, colleagues, that those words, world-class level, may never have been uttered in this building in the same context of agency performance, government performance. But that's what we should expect, is world-class level performance. The question is, how do we as legislators and the legislative assembly engage with the executive branch to help move in that direction? And that's 1039 is an excellent complementary bill to Senate Bill 474, which has the broad requirement that agencies in the budget process that they focus on continuous improvement and developing those plans that will reduce cost, improve quality, and increase the efficiency and performance of the agencies. This bill takes it to a different level. 1039 takes it to a different level in that it creates a committee on performance excellence. The governor makes appointments. The legislative assembly makes leadership makes appointments, bringing in people from the outside that have proven experience in the business world to with respect to continuous improvement, quality improvement plans, and bringing those to play in this Committee on Performance Excellence that would work with the executive branch in selecting specific agencies to focus on and developing the plans and the processes that will, in fact, lead to world-class government. So these two bills are very compatible. 474 has an expectation for continuous improvement. And 1039 is more the facilitating, how do we target specific agencies and help in that process. So, Mr. Chairman, colleagues, again, thank you for hearing these bills this morning, and would entertain any questions or comments.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate your bringing these bills forward. And Senator Byatt.
Thank you.
Stuck on Senator.
A little confusing as it would be, the two of us there. But thank you. As I'm looking at 474 and trying to figure out the legislative assembly adopting, in your mind, this is like a resolution that would be adopted by both chambers? Because I will clarify this by saying that there are still a few of us in the building that are smarting from a previous session where an agreement like this was reached without any input from a good percentage of the body. So I think I'd like a little reassurance that that type of a thing wouldn't happen again.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I mean, that's exactly why this is crafted this way. It specifically says adopted by the Assembly. So it would preclude a select group signing some hidden document with seven or eight signatures on it that it purportedly bind the rest of the body. So this is to give you and the rest of the members of the Assembly some honest buy-in that, you know, it can be, some people can craft a template document, but it will not be adopted until you have the opportunity with the rest of your colleagues to buy into this, and wouldn't go forward unless 16 individuals in this body thought, yes, this is a reasonable template for starting our budget discussions. Good point.
Thank you.
Representative Galizia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. And structural reform is definitely needed, so this is exciting to even be talking about this and thinking about this. And I haven't read through the entire bill, so which brings up actually one of the questions I have or potential concerns is as a citizen legislature, we don't have sufficient time in the status quo, certainly, to really delve as deeply as we should in all of the issues. And as someone who's new to Ways and Means, it's been a real struggle and a challenge. So one of my concerns is if you're, while transparency and openness and buy-in and involvement is great, in terms of just pragmatism and the necessity for efficiency and people with great familiarity with the numbers, one of my concerns would be, you know, to what extent can people really make informed decisions? And secondly, it seems like to me it would be very difficult to reach agreement on these broad numbers. And then also on Section 4, I guess I'm the justification for if general fund revenues are greater than the amount on which the spending agreement was reached, you have these sort of mechanistic numbers of 25% will go to the ending balance, 50% to the stability fund, and I'm just wondering why, when you have humans in the legislature, you want to have this kind of mechanistic decision making.
Good. Yeah, good comment.
That is why.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lizio, good comments and very thoughtful. In the old days, the budget was made by one or two people only. And if you think it's a tough process now, the era of Deb Potts, who used to hold hearings by himself in his own room, knocking out bills with majority votes of one, we've come a long, long way, baby. It's that type of thing. What I would envision, now that we're past this term limits issue, is that members will come back with some knowledge. It does require, I think, as Co-Chair Ways and Means, a certain amount of knowledge to become even remotely familiar with maybe a base budget or delving into and cutting some programs out of a base budget for some newer programs that I or you think are of higher value. I think with the citizen legislature, it is a tough process. I think for citizens, we have a smarter legislature now than they had in the old days, if I may say so, and that's told to me by others who have been around this building a lot longer than I. That can be a curse. It can be a blessing. A blessing in that you have more thoughtful people that want to get engaged, want to understand things, don't feel comfortable voting for things unless they understand things. It's a curse because they don't necessarily trust some of the people who have been around the building a long time, and it makes it tougher to get things done. I'm optimistic that with the annual session issue, the way it's being approached at this point, that there will actually be a budget committee, whether it be the Joint Ways and Means Committee that continues through the interim, or a variation on that, that the 6 months prior to session begins to put the elements of this type of resolution template together so that they can be talking to their caucuses, they can be talking to other members, they can be talking to the public and the advocates before you walk in the door, so that there's actually an opportunity for much more informed discussion come January 8th or 14th or whenever we actually walk into this building. And then I think it's up to members, if you want to get engaged, to spend some time. There's a lot of people that want to be on Ways and Means. There's a lot of people that want to be part of the decision-making process but don't want to put the effort in. It takes a tremendous amount of effort, as you have seen in particular, Mr. Chair, both of you as chairs, all three of you as chairs, to try and get up to speed and understand, you know, the whole realm of what's going on here. It will demand a great deal out of us, a great deal. I think we're equal to task. I see the people before me, and you all are extremely capable, very, very capable. It may take some restructuring of who's on Ways and Means and how we do this, but I think with the interim work being much more productive, we can get there. To the percentage issues that you reflect there, with all due respect, I think Senator Bates has a little bit of a handle on that discussion. The goal here is to set some parameters about what happens when more money comes in. Do we just spend it all? I say no, and I think the people outside this building say no. Do we save it all? I don't think the advocates or, frankly, many of you would think that's prudent. There may be some needs at the end of session that were not addressed early on that need to be addressed. The body as a whole feels are just critical. We're going through that process right now. We're going through that process right now. So I will say, and my colleague, correct me, Representative Jensen, correct me also, as he's a progenitor of this bill too, I don't think these are biblical. These percentages are just meant to be a guidance, to kind of point out that we should save some of that money, some of that might want to go into new programs, and some should be directed to ending balances for exigencies that may occur, such as our county situation right now. We need to make sure we have a reasonable ending balance when we come back in in February of next year. So that's the general outline, sir.
If I may, Mr. Chair, comment.
Senator Morris.
One thing that's certainly unspoken, but it would be one of the impacts of this bill, is it changes, fundamentally changes the role of our legislative fiscal office to require a greater degree of leading the process for the committees. And with respect to the comment with Representative Galizio's comment about how do you get up to speed and how do you move, it really transfers more responsibility to legislative fiscal to help members, you know, chart a process and a path that allows us to move expeditiously, you know, listening to hearings. And the input from the public is so important in this process. And one of the frustrations I sense is we hear, but yet the ability to make those changes are difficult in the process we have today. This changes, switches that around. The other thing that I would suggest we consider is if we move to annual sessions, and we do have, you know, we had two bills in play this session, well, actually one, that would create annual sessions, a referral to amend the Constitution to create annual sessions, one of 120 days in the odd year and 60 days in the even year. And if we stay with a biennial budget, which I think that's the consensus, is that we, even going to annual sessions, we stay with biennial budgets, how do we move this budget process through 120 days? And that's a huge change. And so it creates a greater degree of discipline on our part. It creates a more prescriptive process. In order to get us there and get us out in 120 days. And that's my sense of where we will be going if we're successful this session in demonstrating to the public that we can manage with this sideboard of June 29th and that we come back into session in February. My hope is, in fact, as a member of the Public Commission on the Legislature and on our Senate Legislative Reform Committee, is that we will, in fact, then refer to the public a constitutional amendment to create annual sessions, but to do it in 120 days and 60 days. So the question is, in this budget process, how do we make that work? And that's something we need to be thinking about and planning for.
Senator Bates, then Senator Johnson.
Thank you. First off, thanks for bringing this legislation forward. It makes a lot of sense to me, having been through this now four times. It's a logical way to go. And if I understand it correctly, and I'm just going to make a few statements, I want to make sure that I've got the picture here. You want to change the process for how we produce a budget. You want that budget based on need and how well that agency or that program is functioning, key performance measures, that sort of thing, brought up from the committee level to form what is going to be, by March 31st, the size of the pie, based not on what revenue is available or not available, but based on real need, determined here inside the building, with help from LFO and everyone involved. And to make that a buy-in for everybody in the building, we vote on it. We action across both floors and vote on it. And then when the May forecast comes out, we have to decide if we've got enough revenue to cover those budgets. If we don't, I assume this can go either way. If we have excess revenue, it goes in the ending fund balance, possibly some of that going into the rainy day fund, which should be established finally this year after 150 years or whatever number you want to use. But if there's short revenue, it will lead to a discussion of increased revenue for that session, depending on what the need was, whether we're in recession or not, and tap the rainy day fund, or maybe have to go out for new revenue. So it could push this thing either way. It would appear to me also that if we're working through these committees, we find the need in this state is much higher than we thought it was, that it might push the discussion past just getting through one session. Might push it past just what was our May forecast. It may lead us to a discussion of how we raise revenue in this state, which I think is a bigger question but a very important one. And many of us feel that the revenue system we have is not stable enough and may in some areas be inadequate. So I assume it leads to all those types of questions. The companion piece to me seems to be we have to prove the public and to ourselves that the money we're spending is being well spent. And that's why these two are tied together. I would offer that DHS already has a pilot program going for that with outside consultants from the business world. You probably know about that. So is my overall picture of this basically correct? Have I covered the points that we're trying to look at here as far as changing a very complicated process and making it something we can all buy into more?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, yes, I think you framed it exceedingly well. The age-old yin and yang in this budget process is how much revenue do we have and what's the need? And this basically attempts to juxtapose those two and have the assembly that's elected by the great people of the state come to grips with that up front and have may lead to a biennial discussion, could lead to a broader discussion. But I think it's very important that we have the discussion. Everyone wants buy-in. Everyone wants to be part of the decision. But you have to own that decision, which means you have to be willing to make a stand and have a rough size of the pie and budget allocations based on your knowledge, knowledge of your peers that are experts in the different areas. And you have to own that. You have to be willing to take the heat from the public, from the advocates, your friends, your neighbors, and very few people here to date have been willing to do that. It takes a special breed of person. I'm hoping that's everybody in this legislature 2 years from now.
I would suggest that we think of this budget resolution as a guidance document, because that's essentially what it becomes early on in the process. Set the broad parameters, and then the charge essentially to us on ways and means to make things fit within that guidance document that we all have an opportunity to put our imprint on, either approving or disapproving. So you know where the center of gravity is in the assembly before we launch into the specifics of where we make our allocations, but do it on broadly with a guidance document.
Senator Johnson.
I apologize for being late. You may have touched on this, and stop me if you have, but when you talk about the center of gravity, just trying to figure out sort of where what's in the constellation right now. I've had the same committee assignments for the last four sessions and am just now beginning to understand some of the intricacies of one of the agencies that I have been tasked with knowing a lot about. I don't know how to begin to undo the sort of snake ball that has occurred in some of the agencies to really find out how does the money move through agencies? Where are the programmatic pieces? We talk a lot about transparency and judging through performance measures whether or not programs are efficacious. But in some agencies, you see layer on layer of political activity that has guided the program delivery of the agency. And I'm trying to figure out, I couldn't be more supportive of the direction that you're headed, but I'm trying to figure out how do you begin to drill down into the agencies to actually take them apart to build up a better and newer process where you have all this embedded political activity. And I won't be coy, OECDD, Oregon Economic and Community Development, is one where if you go back and read the statutes, you can almost name the legislators that added different bits and pieces to that agency. But I'm trying to figure out, where do you get to the baseline to begin to build a new process? How does your plan talk about taking these embedded things in agencies and beginning to break them apart so we can actually see and understand what's going on following the money through the agencies to begin to build a better framework of budgeting?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I think this is the first step in those in that direction. If we can accomplish this much, this will provide an opportunity for increased knowledge and understanding by the legislature as a whole, and in particular the people on Ways and Means, as to what's going on in these budgets. I think Senator Morris hit the nail on the head. It requires, frankly, more effort from LFO. We probably need to augment our workforce in LFO to be able to handle some of the workload that's being anticipated here. But I think between the interim work that I referenced and the LFO work that Senator Morris referenced, that provides us an opportunity to dig deep. My two cents, and this is just me talking, it's not directly relevant, I think, to this particular legislation, would be that the way I would anticipate things work was the way it worked when I was a minority member on Ways and Means. If a particular legislature has a particular interest or aptitude in an agency or an area within an agency, I think the co-chairs, the Senate President, Speaker of the House, would give them great latitude to dig deep, to go below, if you will, that we now have prioritized lists that have not gotten much attention, if you will, this session. We've talked a lot about performance outcomes. But because we have money this session, are not so worried about cutting budgets per se, we have prioritized lists that I would hope, I really, really hope, that members of this committee would be looking at and say, well, why do we have this toxicology thing? You know, I thought we already had public health over here, and really start to ask those in-depth questions that would inform us over the long term. And I certainly think the interim here is going to be crucial. If we continue to have a joint ways and means process and a budget committee, if you're working throughout the interim that's reflective of the knowledge you all have gained in the last 6 months, I think that would be a powerful way to start to begin the discussion you're talking about, Senator.
Yes, just a quick question on the adoption of the resolution and the modification of the resolution. Does that just require a majority vote, or is that a 60% vote, or what? I didn't see that how that's stated in the act.
It would be a majority vote. That's where right. I think we've headed with this, Mr. Chair and Senator Witz. It's the 31 and the 16. Hopefully, it's not 31 and 16. If it is,
that's a good point.
You're a little bit in trouble.
I agree.
In a divided assembly. But finding that, as we had referenced, that center of gravity early on is really important. It gives us a direction on ways and means of where to go.
Senator Bates.
I'm just quickly reading through this bill. If we're in a situation where a resolution has been passed deciding the size of the budgets and excess revenue above and beyond those budget is produced while we're still in the assembly, while we're still meeting, according to this bill, as I read it, 25% goes to ending balance, 50% goes to Education Stability Fund. But 25% is taken by the co-chairs at their discretion to be used as they think it should be used. That seems contradictory to kind of what we're doing here. What's the thinking behind that?
I think the intent was for the co-chairs just to make a recommendation, and then the subcommittees, of course, make the final determination. And if you want to change that, that's fine, too. I think that's a good point.
We could change that and let that 25% go to the House District 58.
I was thinking
of
District 3, personally.
And as I said, we have some structure here.
Which may be why we should leave it with what they've done.
Okay.
Might be a wise choice.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'm sort of jumping back and forth between the two bills. One of the things that you call out in Senate Bill 1039 is strategic planning. And I'm trying to think about business plans and developing business plans that any civilian business would develop match revenues to execute on. And what seems to be in some of our agencies a lack of strategic planning that survives longer than 2 years. I don't know how you insulate agencies if they do develop strategic plans against the vicissitudes of a legislative session where power changes, sometimes you have a chief executive change, that would want to inform a different kind of strategic plan. Going back to economic development, I just happen to be thinking about that a lot right now because it's a budget that is taking some time to put together. But if I sat down on an airplane next to somebody and they said, tell me you're in the Oregon legislature, what's Oregon's strategic plan for economic development? How nice it would be to be able to have that with some durability that you could actually begin to execute on it and have enough time to see whether or not you're making a difference. And I don't know how we as a body insulate against these abrupt turns with change of administration, either at the legislative level or at the executive level. And maybe just your comments on that. How do we develop plans that we can buy into and execute on?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I would submit that by moving to performance outcomes, you have a chance of doing that, the greatest chance. Our K-12 budget, for instance, we put a lot of money into that potentially this session. And it would appear that we should demand some great results. I think there are those in the education community that are a little afraid, not of delivering on the results, but how soon do you expect those results? As you know, whether it's OECDD, the state police, K-12, some of the changes will take 2, 4, maybe 6 years. So I'm hopeful that by having a committee hearing and you all voting and the legislature ultimately voting on these budgets with these particular performance outcomes, that that gives the agency that little degree of protection that, okay, you know, here's where I'm supposed to deliver, here's the package I've got. In 4 years, I expect with my ETIC allocation to not only get, hire more faculty, get more students, but in 4 years graduate more engineers. And that, to me, is a great comment that will require, again, as Senator Morris alluded to, more LFO, bringing things forward, reminding legislators about the history of the original budget allocation. But it protects the agencies a little bit from the yin and yang of Senator Johnson or Senator Schrader wanting to change course. They can say, well, that's interesting, Senator, appreciate your comments, but the previous legislature had us going down this track. We've been spending money just like they told us. You know, and it gives you an opportunity as an agency head, I think, to push back gently, respectfully, saying, hey, I'm just doing what you told me to do. Please give us a chance to deliver on that original product. So I'm hopeful that that's a big part of how we get to what you're talking about. And I think a lot of the problem with agencies going back and forth is the legislature. And frankly, it's been a process where whoever's in charge gets to decide what programs happen or don't. This type of framework that we're talking about, both with 1039 and 474, helps get it slightly more objective. You never want it to be totally objective, because gosh darn it, that's why we're elected by the people, to make changes in a strategic course. It's a strategic document, not a tactical document. And I think this gets us much further down the road. And 1039 just institutionalizes the idea of performance and excellence and really coming up with a bold strategic plan that can be implemented over a period of time. I would, talking too much, I apologize, but I would respectfully suggest that over the last couple of biennia, particularly in our relationships with certain partners, you know, this legislature has walked the talk. We haven't been able to fully fund various programs in the depths of the recession, but we made commitments about what we would do, and we've lived up to those commitments over a period of time. And I think that speaks highly for each and every one of you, and I would hope that would continue.
One follow-up.
As
we embark on this kind of new strategy to do budgeting, and I hope we do, and it begins to become part of the culture of this place, I hope that we go the next step and require the same degree of performance for those recipients of public money that come through our state agencies, so that we can actually see outcomes and deliverables and efficacy for vast amounts of money that come through this building that we ostensibly lose control of once it moves out. And so I hope this is just the beginning of our ability to judge how well we're spending money at the end of sometimes very long chains of pass-through.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just one quick question, because it isn't totally clear to me, but I assume that this is how it would be, is that the budget and this agreement are moving forward at the same time, that we're not having to wait on budgets to get this agreement before we start working budgets?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brad, that's correct. And I would say the same thing about policy bills. Nothing in this legislation, you have to read it carefully, prohibits policy bills from moving forward. But it does bind us a little bit on both budget and policy bill issues if this resolution by March 31st, if you want. I mean, the date is not, again, written, cast in stone. It reflects, I think, past practices last couple of sessions, and it's been doable. So it's a reasonable date by which, I think, to perform this. I would assume that the budgets would move forward. There would be an informed discussion on a general outline beforehand, somewhat informed by your initial look at the budgets in general. Maybe it changes how the orientation is for Ways and Means. Maybe a little longer, more general emphasis than what we've been doing heretofore if we have this resolution in place. And our staff, I think, would help guide us through that. But I think this is an opportunity, great opportunity.
Senators, I'm forced to ask one question or make one observation, I think. Senator Morris, as you were giving your initial discussion, you talk about wanting world-class performance out there by agencies, by parts of the state government, and so forth. And I don't think I would particularly disagree with that. I don't want to make it sound that way, but the question seems obvious to me about how can I demand world-class performance out there when we do not provide the resources that are necessary to get to the world-class performance. Now, you know, I've been in this building almost as long as Senator Co-Chair Schrader, and I've watched us throw up our hands in despair with that's the best we can do. If we want world-class performance, that's not adequate. That response is not adequate. Someone has to bite the bullet and, make some sort of commitment to adequate resources to go with or to enable us to achieve, that world-class performance. And no disrespect to the current co-chairs or anyone, that has necessarily preceded that, nor any members of body that have preceded this. But we simply haven't gotten close in doing that. And, of course, we say it's out of our hands. And maybe Senator Bates struck talk on this a little bit, but this is the concern of how do we get over this hurdle.
If I might respond, Mr. Chair, I believe that where you're taking that question is focusing on the adequacy of revenue to do what voters out there have said they want done. And we do, in fact, have a structural budget gap. There's a huge gap between what voters want and expect and what we have by way of resources to meet those needs. And that's why we have looked at this comprehensively in terms of revenue, budget reform, or revenue reform, it's called tax reform, budget reform, spending reform, saving reform, to think comprehensively, because the issue you raise is a real issue before us. And that's the adequacy of revenue.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, obviously, I suppose everyone knew where I was coming from when the statement was made, but we look at the companion bills that have come along with this that would certainly point to that. But I would be remiss, I think, if I didn't try to make that point crystal clear in this committee that you can't have the world-class reform or the world-class schools or the world-class whatever it is unless you're willing to make the commitment for the resources necessary to get you to that particular point. I kind of struck this morning, and we've had a considerable amount of problems as far as China is concerned in recent months with tainted foods of one form or another, ranging from dog food to toothpaste. And I saw in the paper this morning that China's made a pretty significant commitment to world-class competition. They didn't even play games with it. They just went out and shot the guy that was in charge. not making this as a suggestion of where we want to go, but if this is what we're competing with.
I might not get the proper response from the agency, sir. But
Mr. Chair, was that pointed at agency heads or at heads of major committees?
I think in this case, it was probably a bureaucratic somebody.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. I would like to push back just a little bit in that I think that world-class performance does not necessarily require across-the-board increases in revenue and revenue resources. I think that increase in effort, better management, and improvement of process, and what we're trying to aim at with our performance measures and excellence in management and performance can be reached, I think, without huge increases in resources. I think there are some areas where we need more resources, but I think that by improving the process and the management, we might be able to significantly approach that excellence in performance without huge increases in resources.
Thank you, Senator. Yes.
Go ahead.
I was ready to leave, sir.
Oh, I just want to. I know we don't have time.
The co-chair is ready to leave.
Okay, but really quickly, no, this is important. First, again, thank you both. I especially want to thank the co-chair, to whom I will be asking for more money this committee. So thank you for bringing this important legislation. Just two comments, really. One is, and I wish Senator Bates were here, Senator Schrader, you said that the numbers weren't biblical in Section 4 in terms of the automatic percentages, and I think that's a really significant part of this legislation, and that's an important philosophical debate. Because arguably, businesses need flexibility in addition to discipline and adaptability. That's really important, so that's a part that's concerning. And secondly, until this body obtains the courage to deal with the initiative system, or the initiative industrial complex, as some people call it, these types of structural reforms are really important, but until we get a handle on that, and I include myself in not doing what we need to do, this state is going to continue to have enormous difficulties and problems. So, but again, thank you for bringing this legislation.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have a couple of folks that have signed up, Mr. King, and I put my glasses on. Christy Ryan? Chen Ryan? Yes. Mr. King? Fred King?
Yes. Who do you want first? Both of us together?
Sure.
Okay.
Please. Unless you're going to fight, in which case we'll take one at a time.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, and members of the committee, first I want to thank you for scheduling this public meeting hearing, and I appreciate your efforts to accommodate all of us who wish to testify. I am Christine Chen Ryan, President of Synergy Consulting, Inc. I also serve as Chair of the Oregon Small Business for Responsible Leadership and Chair of the Governor's Small Business Council. Today, I'm representing myself as a small business owner. Synergy Consulting, Inc. is a small business technology firm providing customized software development focused on the energy sector with emphasis on conservation, energy efficiency, and renewables for 19 years. I wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 1039, to establish a committee on performance excellence. As a business owner in the technology industry, we have created and implemented our own software development methodology and quality control, which engenders trust and confidence both in me and in my products and services. We are constantly discussing and recommending the most efficient, least expensive, and highest system and data integrity. We have a reputation of completing quality work on time and within budget. Many feel that performance measures are difficult to implement in a large government entity. It is, but it is achievable. I want to tell you about one of our longest clients, Bonneville Power Administration. They successfully implemented performance measurements called performance indicators on the Columbia River System dams that is operated by the Corps of Engineers and Bureau of Reclamation. Performance indicators include things like safety, according to OSHA standards, forced outage factor, availability factor, heavy load hour availability, increased megawatts target, capital expense, hydro-amp targets, work profile analysis. Level of expectations, which are the target levels, are set by the group in order to meet performance standards for the system. Minimum performance is required to achieve bonuses, which stretch target sets to add to the bonuses. These bonuses are distributed to all employees at all levels. This has started since 2000, and it's on its second cycle, which they have increased the performance standards. It's a very successful project in the federal agencies connecting the operations of all the federal dams in the Pacific Northwest. So I think it's very achievable, and I think as a business owner, it does need to happen, and the state of Oregon is already doing performance measures in some state agencies, as Senator Johnson mentioned, the OECDD, and thank you for stating the problematic situations that I've also have encountered. And some have worked with the Progress Board on establishing performance measures. I think this bill can be seen as the next evolutionary step as the legislature continues its effort towards transparency and accountability and will help to regain the trust of Oregon citizens. On that line, I'd like to just say on Senate Bill 474, what I've been hearing a lot around the state is talking to small business owners, that the public doesn't trust the state legislators and state agencies. It's a lot of wasted money. And I think Senate 474, as you, Representative Galizio, I have not read it all, and in fact, I think it's a little bit more to get into, and I think it's more for the legislators to, if I understand it, makes the budget process better. And if it does make the budget process better, I'm all for it, if it helps you in budgeting for the state and for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. King.
Mr. Chair, Senators, Representatives, my name is Fred King. I'm the CEO and co-owner of Hollander Management Consultants, a company located in Tualatin, Oregon. I have, for the last 25 years, helped over 4,000 service businesses across the United States and Canada put in performance measurements. This has been done primarily in the healthcare field. I am a board member for the Oregon chapter of the NFIB, and I'm a member of the Governor's Small Business Council. But today I come to you as an individual and a business taxpayer advocating for SB 1039 and what it can do for Oregonians. And for those Oregonians, many who have lost their faith in government, especially in what their taxes pay for. I have had the opportunity the last 9 months to speak to the Chambers of Commerce and at the Oregon Mayor's Conference on Task Fiscal Reform. Two main points that were constantly made to me by those in attendance during my talks and afterward were these. We don't trust that our money is being spent wisely, and nearly no one knew there was such a thing as a performance measurement in state government or believed it. Yesterday I had a staff meeting like I do every Monday morning, and I asked my 50 staff that were there these questions. Do you believe state government spends their dollars wisely? And the answer was no. Do you believe if there are performance measurements in state government, the government would be better held accountable and your dollars would be better spent? The answer was a definite yes. Now, my staff might be a little different, as each one has performance measurements and has been educated in this area and know what it can do for morale, production, efficiency, accountability, and viability for a company. It is so important for Oregonians to reconnect to their government and understand what is happening with their tax money and what are the results that their government is getting. There's no way to do that without performance measurements. I've had the opportunity to go to the website, the Oregon Progress Board. I've had a couple of meetings with Rita Howard of the Oregon Progress Board. I have lightly reviewed what is happening here in the area of performance measures. From my viewpoint, this is an underutilized, underfunded, understaffed activity. Implementing SB 1039 will help begin to solve the public relations problem that divides this state between taxpayers and those who work for them. This distrust is there, and this bill begins to solve the problem directly. SB 1039 puts in a structure that can help solve the most basic problem that any organization faces. Where are we going? How are we going to get there? And how do we measure it? Putting SB 1039 in place is not the answer. It's the beginning. It will not be easy. There will be those who do not want to be measured for what they do, who will hide from the spotlight and will try to undermine this concept. But I have found that once someone fully understands how we can help them get the results for their job or position, they become very strong advocates for it. The measurement can be incorrectly done, and it can be used in a negative manner. Nothing is perfect. Most public servants I have spoken to welcome this if it is done fairly and with their input. And that's the important part, their input. SB 1039 puts in transparency to government as never before. I'd like to see things also added to this bill. One, an easier-to-use website so all Oregonians can see what is happening. If you tried to go through that website, I don't know about you, but I got lost. Two, some type of budget-to-performance connection. Three, and some type of marketing or PR activity to really promote to the people of Oregon what is happening. It's important that Oregonians know what's happening here, as this is an evolutionary as well as revolutionary activity. I want to deeply thank the sponsors of this bill for sponsoring it and for all of you taking the time and courage to do something about this. That's it.
Thank you.
Quickly. Sorry. Thank you both for testifying. Do you think taxpayers would like their tax dollars spent on marketing and public relations to show the same taxpayers that their government, that actually includes, I think we're all taxpayers as far as I know, is you know, performing well? And do you think people in Oregon on the whole pay much attention to really and know what's going on in this building?
Yeah.
I think there are many ways of marketing or doing PR. You have a lot of boards and commissions, like for example the Governor's Small Business Council go around the state in off-session years. We get input from small businesses where we feel pretty good that we are truly representing small businesses across the state. There are other committees that go around. There's also Brand Oregon that is used to highlight the state, and I think potentially that could be tapped into. Obviously I'm not sure this is potential. I think that the state has done many good things, and I think that marketing as a business owner is a big aspect of selling that. And I think there are ways to inform. And I, obviously, the less spend on marketing, the better, but I think there are other means to doing it at a very low cost.
I agree.
Thank you. Real quick, as I'm listening to this, I certainly, it's a comment more than a question, want to acknowledge that we do, the legislature definitely has a PR problem and government in general does. But I think every time someone goes out and repeats the phrase that in general the public doesn't trust government, that just adds more people out there that are saying, oh, I'm not supposed to trust government. And there are enough of them out there as it is. But I just think that we perpetuate that by the way we talk. And I think sometimes we need to be looking at that as opposed to just telling everybody what great things are happening. I just think that it's just this, endless cycle that we just keep perpetuating.
May I respond, Mr. Chair? As we go around the state and talking to small businesses, many of my members have talked to chambers and so on. We actually have represented our positions, which throughout the year we have met with actually the four senators on the fiscal reform and also with the two senators on the health care. Because we think those are good things. There's good for small businesses to have those programs in place. So we are actually helping in selling something good for all Oregonians, and we are bringing back these comments because it's consistent throughout. We try our best. Obviously, we can't just close our ears. We have to listen as part of what we need to do. But we do try and explain as much as possible that, the legislators, we are working with them. They are listening to us as small business owners. We try and put in the positive aspects of it. And I think actually we're doing a pretty good job of it because we just started going around the state for the last, 3 years. I just wanted to make sure that if I heard correctly, that we're not the ones putting it out there, is we're getting that feedback, and we have to listen to it, and we have to bring it back to let you know. But we're also there to, I think, express some, you know, positive messages that we have experienced.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that one point?
Quickly.
I will. Just in regards to that, I think it's very important that as citizens that we really listen to the other citizens, because it is a PR problem. It is. It is dramatic, and I think one of the biggest ways to deal with it is to point out this is a problem and here's our solution. And our solution to that is to make sure that everybody knows that the government is with you, not on the other side of the bench, and make that a very positive note in regards to it. And that's it.
Mr. Jensen, just to comment and to run it by you, you talk about mistrust in the public. I think that's certainly there. We have a tendency in this building to think it is apathy, that the people don't participate. I'm more of the opinion that it is abject disgust on the part of the public on the way our government works. Would you comment on that?
That's a very good point. Since I haven't surveyed everybody in regards to it, I don't feel like I can answer it for the general public. For the people who I have talked to and been out and about, I think disgust is probably a hard word. I'd probably try to use some other synonym that would reflect similar things. I don't think, but I do believe there is an apathy, you know, and I think part of that apathy is founded upon, you know, what's the use, what can we do, and that type of a thing. Once, when you bring out the idea that it's very, you know, something that we're looking at measuring something, or we're looking at putting some activity on it, people perk up. They go, oh, yeah, and then they go from there. So that's my best PR response for you.
In concluding of this, as somewhat of a student of American history and not of all state histories, but I observe that what we're talking about here is literally as old as the nation itself, and actually predates the nation state as such, and is perhaps well summed up by Samuel Clemens in his statement. Supposing you were a member of Congress. Supposing you were an idiot. But I repeat myself. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 474 and Senate Bill 1079.
Thank you.
And with this, then we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2656. And if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House Bill 2656 is one of those construction claims task force bills that you talked about when you worked the construction contractors board budget. And Mr. Long is here, and he's been generous enough to say that to offer to give you a little brief history on the task force and the bills that have come forward and how this relates to it. So with your permission, Mr. Chair, if we could call Mr. Long up, and
please.
I'm sure he can do a much better job than I explaining this bill.
And for the record,
good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the administrator of State Building Codes Division, which we're part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I also served during the interim as staff to the Construction Claims Task Force. House Bill 2656 is a Construction Claims Task Force recommendation. I've made available to you an executive summary of the task force, and I just want to give you a quick overview of that and then specifically what's contained in this bill. The task force met, again, as a result of House Bill 2078 passed in the 05 session during the last interim. We had 16 meetings really looking at construction defects, the affordability and availability of insurance, and how we might improve the construction environment. We put together multiple panels of experts, had 30-some invited individuals come testify, 400 submissions of information. I think the task force looked at 70 to 80 different recommendations, and it all got synthesized down into 11 recommendations that came before that were part of the task force report. 2656 focuses, is a preventive nature, and it focuses on competency and training standards for contractors who work on building envelopes. As part of the task force work, we also conducted an insurance study because we were looking at affordability and availability. And I just want to share something that we found through that insurance study. 84% of the defects around construction were related to water intrusion, and 78% directly related to the envelope. If you look at just averages from the affordability and availability side, between 98 and 2005, according to our study, contractor insurance rates went up 113%, which creates a significant problem for those contractors. And if you look at the claims against the general liability policy that contractors are required to have, over half of those were related to construction defects. So it became clear to the task force that water intrusion getting into the building was a significant cause of then the defect, which then leads to higher insurance and affordability and availability. So the task force really wanted to try to get their arms around that, and 2656 is the result of that recommendation. I've provided to you just kind of a section-by-section analysis, if you will, of the bill, and I'd like to kind of go through it with you. There are some changes that need to be made to the A-engrossed version. We've had ongoing discussions with the industry and folks impacted by this to make sure that the bill meets not only the agency's need for the Construction Contractors Board so they can administer it, but also that there's a clear understanding of all the folks that are impacted by this, whether you're in the manufactured housing industry, the site industry, or the commercial contracting industry. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Carmel, this question is going to bug me until I get an answer. Can you define the word envelope for me?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I certainly can, and in the bill it's defined. I think it's in about Section 9, so I want to be consistent with what the bill says. And I might be off by a little bit. If you just give me a second, Representative Crummell. No, that's not it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cole, I believe the definition of a building envelope is the integrated assemblies, components, and materials of a structure that separate the interior space of the structure from the exterior.
There's the technical definition. What we're talking about is roofs, walls, windows, doors. It's basically the exterior part of a structure that keeps water out and weather out. So here's what the bill does, essentially. It requires the contractor to designate a building envelope specialist who would be an individual either in their employ or someone that they contract with that has received training and education in one of three categories. Roofing, what we call exterior finishes, which would be your stucco and your custom finishes, and then siding, which includes your traditional siding, your wood siding that we're familiar with, as well as your doors and windows. Contractor's going to have to make sure that if they're doing that type of work, that they have an appropriately trained person that has that certificate through training that will be established through the Construction Contractors Board, hopefully through private providers, so that it's widely available and easy to obtain from the contractors.
Senator Johnson?
Well,
Senator Webster.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. In relation to that, how does this bill relate to the small contractor, you know, the individual with one or two employees, plus or minus, that builds one quality home at a time?
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsett, it applies to the large and to the small. And so if you're a sole proprietor, as an example, or maybe have one or two employees, and let's say you do roofing work, or we could say roofing, siding, and other kinds of things, but let's just take roofing for now, and I'll be happy to go further. If you do roofing work, either you as an individual or one of your employees that's part of the job crew that does the work will have to obtain this specialized training and education. Hope that answers your question. If you do roofing, siding, and custom exterior finish work, then you might need to have go to three different classes to know that type of information and have those certifications available to you as a contractor.
Follow up. So there is a if you were an individual who builds a house all by yourself, you could actually get certified in all three of those envelope specialties and continue to work.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wetzel, that's correct. Or you could contract for it. It's very flexible to meet the needs.
Senator Johnson.
That was roughly my question, but let me nuance it a little bit further. If I'm a big contractor and I'm doing lots and lots of houses, do I need a certain ratio of houses to certified people, or is one certified person on my staff adequate to visit all of my job sites and review all of the work?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, that's a great question. We spent a lot of time on that issue. We've had some experience in some of the other licensed crafts with that. And the way it came out in the bill is you have to have an individual to substantially observe, and those are the words used in the bill, the installation of the work as part of that crew. We don't provide a ratio. We're not suggesting that there needs to be a ratio. And you simply, as a contractor, have to provide then a document to the local building department before you get CFO. Who is that individual you designated to do that work, and who's the one that you believe took responsibility for that? So you could have one out of five or six on a crew. You could have, we talked about in a subdivision situation where maybe you have two things going side by side, two homes going side by side. You need to have one that can substantially observe that work, could bounce back and forth. Some crews, some commercial contractors are going to have all their employees do it. Some might have one. It's really written kind of flexibly as a first approach to this training and education problem that we've come across.
Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up, then I presume somewhere along the line substantially observe is going to get litigated to put sideboards around what substantially observe means. Maybe you can help me with the deliberations of the task force.
Sure. Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, that particular piece, the task force recommended a training and education program. It was a little bit more robust than what this bill has. What this bill is based on the task force recommendation, but it went through, I believe, two-month-long kind of work group discussion deliberation in the House side. I think Representative Galizio is familiar with that, saying on consumer protection. And what was agreed upon was the substantially observed. I understand that there is some opportunity for different interpretations, but I think that the consensus of the folks that were part of it and myself is this is the first step Oregon's taking in this area. It was awfully difficult to mandate for all types of builders, small as well as large, exactly how to do this. So they have to substantially observe, and they have to provide documentation of who did that work to the building department. That's kind of where we left it. I know I haven't answered your question, but that was the background of how we got here today.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Sorry. I guess my question is, how onerous do you anticipate this training to be? Is it something that you think is not lengthy, time-consuming training, or?
Chair Jensen, Representative Beyer, frankly, I don't know yet, because as the task force went through this process, there were indications that there are many companies out there that provide this in other states, and then British Columbia. We've set it up flexibly so that the Construction Contractors Board can approve training providers, and then private training providers can be made available to the public, hopefully in all areas of the state, so that you can get through the courses. We've heard folks talk anywhere from a two-day course to a four-day course. I don't have the details of that yet, and one of the key elements is there's an advisory committee set up, I believe, in one of the sections in the bill that's going to help the Construction Contractors Board in the state kind of figure out all those different pieces and have the board adopt rules. But again, what we thought was important was allowing this to be, the training to be conducted by private entities. I can tell you, my familiarity, licensing electricians and plumbers, we have only over 60 providers that do electrical training, continuing education training alone that we approve. My hope is that you'll see something along those lines, maybe not quite that much, but along those lines, that to make it available in all areas of the state and to customize to different groups, because I think the commercial builders are going to want to focus in one area, and I think the residential builders will want to focus, but all get a basic level of training.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I just need to let the committee know that there are a couple areas that as we've continued to meet with folks, that will be brought to you in an amendment that are different than the A engrossed version, and that occurs in Section 2. The bill as written requires a quality control checklist to be completed by the contractor. That's been removed, and simply as a proposed amendment, which we'll bring before to you, which will simply just ask them to have the name and the certification number of the individual to provide back to the building department. Many folks thought that the quality assurance checklist would lead to, frankly, a potential litigation problem, and so we agreed to take that out. There's minor changes that were requested in the advisory committee. Just a couple words. The advisory committee, I think, has 9 members. One of them says it's a subcontractor. We say subcontractor involved in building envelope work, so that it's clear that on the advisory committee it needs to be somebody that kind of comes out of this world. In Section 8 of the bill, and I probably should have talked about this, the other piece that this bill does and that the task force recommended is providing continuing education to all contractors. Currently, you may be aware that once you're licensed as a general contractor, having ongoing continuing education is not a requirement in Oregon. And we felt that that was pretty important as part of this overall package of training and education. Well, we're specifically focusing on folks that do building envelope work, but also providing a mechanism for continuing education in all areas. That's found in Section 8. That same exact language is in another bill that's frankly up today on the Senate side, and I believe will pass, but we'll find out. And so we may need to modify that out as well, just so that we don't have a conflict. It's the identical language. And then the last piece. Yeah.
I just. This is a new mandate, so you're getting rid of all of the grandfathered folks, if I understood you correctly.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we would require the existing contractors to take continuing education. There's 2 components, and I'm going to back up just so I make sure I'm clear. If you work on the building envelope, roofs, walls, those things, you're going to have a specialized training through the certification that we're talking about. That has its own set of components of education and training. If you're a general contractor and do a variety of different things, you're going to have ongoing continuing education. Right now, that's not a requirement for general contractors. And so I'm a framer, if you will. I'm making this up, of course. And that is the area that I work in. The Construction Contractors Board would set a continuing education requirement. And if you look in the bill, it could include business practices, codes, material standards. And in their, I believe it's 2-year license cycle that they have, they would have to have an amount of hours that the Construction Contractors Board determines is necessary to maintain and keep that license, and so they would do that before they renew. I hope I made that clear, Senator.
I'm relying on memory, which is a bad thing, but it struck me that in this discussion earlier, you had a group of contractors who were not they were grandfathered with respect to having to get licenses. Am I remembering this correctly? Our continuing education that there had been.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, I'm going to ask Craig if he can help me with that. He might have the history.
But the point that I'm getting at is if there is now a continuing education element, I think that's a good element, and most professions have that. Lawyers have it. I presume physicians have it. Yeah, so I think it's a good thing, but I'm just trying to refresh my memory as to some body of folks who were not licensed or not required to help me, Craig.
Sure. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. Your memory is again, crystal clear. When the licensing law was passed in 2000, the vast majority of existing contractors were grandfathered in. They therefore didn't need to take a test. 7 years on down the line now, we have about a 1/3 tested contractors versus 2/3 grandfathered in. What this bill would do, and a component of a companion bill, is require all of those contractors, whether they've been tested or not, to take continuing education.
That's a good thing. Thank you.
Where was I? Okay, continuing on with the section by section, another amendment that we'll be bringing to you in Section 11, and this had quite a bit of discussion after the House committee pass this bill out of committee. And this deals with landscape contractors, Bart, and I'll try to make this landscape contractors, and I'll try to make this as clear as possible. One of the main concerns of the Construction Claims Task Force, and one of the leading causes of building envelope failures through testimony that we received, is the installation of decks. Decks that are not flashed properly, or when they're connected to the building envelope, not caulked, sealed, or sloped as necessary, depending upon the situation, can cause problems to the home. And there isn't too many folks that I just talked to anecdotally say, yeah, I had a problem with my deck and it caused this, that, and the other. I've had a problem with this leaking or that leaking and it's caused these types of problems. Well, we're creating a certification requirement for those contractors that are licensed under the Construction Contractors Board. You also have folks licensed under the Landscape Contractors Board who install decks. So it gets kind of complicated. You have CCB licensed folks installing decks and working on a building envelope, and you have Landscape Contractors Board workers installing decks and mounting them to a building envelope. The training components and education is under the CCB board for those folks that they license. You don't have any oversight over the landscape contractors. The landscape contractors were concerned that if deck work required specialized training, that they would have to receive an additional license and additional training. We understood that. So in the House committee, there was an amendment proposed that would have required an additional insurance and additional bond. I'm told, and I'm not an insurance expert, I'm told that the companies that represent the small businesses for landscape contractors will not provide a secondary insurance document to those folks. We essentially have two sets of problems. I don't know that the landscape contractors can meet the requirement that we have in the A and Gross bill because it requires an additional bond and additional insurance, and I'm told that the insurance providers won't sell you two policies to the same business owner because it changes their exposure. And secondarily, there's a policy problem in that if you're a deck installer under the Landscape Contractors Board and you penetrate the building envelope, your scope of work is limited to the deck. So let's say that it causes the problem, you can't go in and fix it because your license won't allow you to do that. And that seems to put the consumer kind of in an awkward spot. And so, amongst other things, we are proposing to go back to the original language that we were kind of working on the House side that would require, if you are a licensed landscape contractor and you choose to install decks where you want to actually penetrate the building envelope and not make it freestanding, that you're going to need to get the appropriate licenses and training through the Construction Contractors Board so that it's the same as the rest of the industry, whether you're commercial, residential, or other. So that issue is in Section 11, and the amendment that we'll be bringing to you will encompass that as well. I hope I've made that clear. It's kind of confusing, but we spent some time talking about it, and I know the representative's familiar with that issue as well. With that, obviously, putting this together from the agency's perspective, Craig's going to need some staff in order to do that, and I think that's why we're here. That isn't part of the this is outside of the governor's recommended budget that you had as part of your budget. So with that, I'll be happy to take any questions about the bill, what we're proposing to do with amendments, background, task force, whatever you'd like to do, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we've reached the bewitching hour. At this point, we're going to carry House Bill 2656 over to tomorrow's session. I think Mr. Shiprack and Mr. Barry are folks that are in the building generally, and I hope that isn't a great inconvenience to you. So, with that, we are adjourned.